This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, the war in Ukraine is never far from our minds. It's the first European war since 1945. It is an invasion by Vladimir Putin on a neighboring country. It has produced something quite shocking. And we passed the 500th day yesterday of this conflict. And throughout that time, Johnny O'Reilly has been reporting for us from Ukraine. Johnny is a journalist and a filmmaker, and he is in Kyiv, but he has been to Kherson, has just come back from Kherson, which has been a center of conflict, an important center of conflict. And also Johnny lived in Russia for some time, so he's entirely familiar with the circumstances. Johnny, thank you very much for joining us on The Stand. The first thing I want to raise with you is actually about a report that's breaking news at the moment of a meeting between Prigozhin and Vladimir Putin. Prigozhin, of course, is the person who attempted, it appears, an insurrection 2 weeks ago and then backed off. But he is an old ally of Putin's, and it is reported in some press at the moment that Prigozhin has been given a task by Putin in order to cement their rapprochement. And the task is to murder President Zelensky. It's an extraordinary news story. We're not entirely sure that it's true, but the sources are credible enough. What do you make of that?
Well, actually, I'm just reading now that the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has confirmed that meeting, but obviously didn't confirm the agreement that you refer to. But
yes.
Yeah, on the 29th of June, 5 days after the failed or the abandoned rebellion, Putin met with Prigozhin and up to apparently 35 people, including unit commanders, and that the meeting lasted about 3 hours. So that's some news that has just come out, and it does reveal a bit more of the state of play between Prigozhin and Putin. Now, with regards to, you know, this leak that it was decided that Prigozhin should arrange for Zelensky's murder. That kind of, again, I would put that in the category of scaremongering.
Yes.
Because they are trying to murder Zelensky and have been doing ever since the beginning of
the
war.
Of course.
So it's no news that they're trying to do that. And Zelensky has his own team of security who are constantly mitigating these threats. So I don't see that as any kind of shift in policy or anything by the Russians. But again, just something to scare people off.
Yes, now we will come to the summer offensive, as it's now being called, launched by Ukraine in a moment. Just before we do, there was a terrible murder of civilians by a cruise missile or a missile of some kind in Kramatorsk. It was a pizza restaurant. The reported number of people dead is 13. One of them was a well-known Ukrainian writer, Victoria Amelina. She was killed, and two 14-year-old twin girls also. There was also a terrible attack on civilians in Lviv within the last few days. These kinds of war crimes, atrocities, attacks on civilians. And I understand, Johnny, that one of the people who was in that restaurant was a friend of yours.
Yes, yeah, she luckily got away with just light injuries, but she's obviously very shook up by the whole experience. And she did tell me everything that happened. She said she had just enough time to close her eyelids. When the missile struck and she was concussed and then managed to get out of there pretty quickly. But 13 civilians were killed in that attack. But this is a restaurant that I know, and it is the one of about three restaurants that are operating in Kramatorsk, and it's considered by the press corps as the best restaurant.
Yes.
So a lot of journalists go there, a lot of NGO workers, but most of all, a lot of soldiers who are on leave, temporary leave from the front lines. They live in Okopovs for, you know, two or three days, and then they have a day or two off, and
yes,
they go to Kramatorsk, and many of them go to this restaurant.
So Ria is the name of the pizzeria.
Yeah,
isn't it? Yes.
It's a very big restaurant. It has all kinds of rooms and balconies and terraces in it. It's two stories high, and it was targeted with an Iskander missile, which is one of the missiles the Russians have, which is, highly precise.
Yes.
So they knew that there would be civilian casualties. But the number of military casualties are not reported by Ukraine. Therefore, you can imagine, you know, given that there were more military personnel there than civilians, what the number might be, given that there was 13 civilian casualties.
It was reported that Ukrainian authorities arrested a man who they believed was outside the restaurant and was, as it were, sending information to the Russians or something of that nature, guiding them in some way. I don't know if there's any development on that, but that was reported, which suggests, well, it could be anybody. But there are still, aren't there, people in Ukraine, individuals and indeed communities that have sympathy for the Russian assault.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, Kramatorsk before the war would have probably been majority pro-Russian.
Right.
Before the invasion, last year. But pre-2014, that would have been different. But certainly, yeah, in a frontline town like Kramatorsk, there would be plenty of sympathizers and people who would be sharing information with the Russians.
Yes, now President Biden is in London at the moment. He's going off to a NATO meeting, and high on the agenda of that meeting will be support for Ukraine to join NATO. Of course, as I'm sure you know, Article 5 of the NATO Charter demands that if one member is attacked, then all the other members will come to their assistance. Now, in the present circumstances, that isn't possible. Is there support? I'm sure there is support, Johnny, for Ukraine joining NATO and indeed joining the EU. And those atrocities that the Russians are committing, they are deeply shocking. Are the Ukrainians as shocked as we are, or is it what you expect? Is it the way Russia fights wars?
Yeah, this is the way Russia fights wars, and of course people are shocked, and you know, people are shocked in Russia as well, because they are getting images that are quite similar in terms,
yes,
of Ukrainian targeting concentrations of Russian troops, where also there would be civilian deaths. That's not to equivocate one with the other. Obviously, on the Ukrainian side, there's a lot more mitigating factors with regards,
yes,
to their military policy. But certainly people are shocked by all of these events, and all the information that comes out of them is almost instantaneous, because there's always people with a mobile phone near any event like that. But with regards to Ukraine's NATO accession, it does seem that Ukraine is going to get, in a communique, language that will commit to some kind of path towards NATO in the distant future. Plus a firmed up security assistance commitment. But short of the outright commitment to a date of joining NATO, but certainly it's another step towards Ukraine's accession to NATO, which won't happen during war, because if it happens during war, then all NATO allies have to join that war. So I don't expect it to for Ukraine to join NATO before the war ends. But I think it was the Minister of Defense who claimed that Ukraine is already a de facto NATO member, given the scale of support and weaponry that has been provided to the country.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Yeah, now weaponry is a problem for Ukraine. It's a problem for the United States of America as well, Joe Biden has admitted. And this has brought into play a very controversial decision by the United States government, by Joe Biden, effectively, I would think, to supply cluster bombs to Ukraine. It is something that the Russians are using, but cluster bombs are very, as you know, volatile and dangerous weapons. And for example, Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, said it's not something that they are very keen on, which is a British understatement for saying they wouldn't have done it. But this war was described yesterday by the joint chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in America, Mark Milley. He told the National Press Club in Washington that although the counteroffensive was advancing steadily, that it would be a long and very bloody war. Is that the sense you have?
Yes, I don't think anything's changed in terms of the chances at you know, how long this could be drawn out. And no one really knows for sure. You know, obviously what could expedite it is a collapse of Putin's political system, another armed rebellion. And that's what, you know, many people hope for. But yeah, when you look at the attrition rates and also the speed of advance on the ground, it does look like it's going to last longer than many people obviously would like. But the thing with war is that it's attritional until there's a breakthrough, and the breakthrough can come very suddenly and can have a knock-on effect in terms of morale, in terms of organization, logistics, elsewhere. So yeah, it's slow and attritional until, you know, everything changes.
Yes.
So it's not something that you can plan for specifically, but certainly the provision of cluster munitions will have an impact on the ground, given the attritional nature of the battle at the moment. You can imagine that most of the battles take place around these trenches, which could be anything from a few hundred meters to a few miles long. So the enemy are entrenched in, you know, 2 meter deep trenches that are very hard to extricate from there.
Yes.
But with the provision of cluster munitions, it does make it easier to destroy enemies' positions in trenches. So it will make a difference depending on how many munitions are provided. But it obviously is a very controversial matter, because most NATO countries have joined the Convention on Cluster Munitions, which incidentally was negotiated over a 10-day period in Croke Park in 2008. Yeah, it was all negotiated in Ireland.
Yeah.
Minister of Foreign Affairs Dermot O'Hearn had set that up.
Right.
And so they negotiated in Croke Park and then signed it in Oslo at the end of 2008. But Russia, Ukraine, and US are not signatories to that. But those cluster munitions that the US wants to provide to Ukraine have been phased out and were not being planned on being used. So it's an easy decision in terms of financing. The difficulty was just the political ramifications of increasing the supply of cluster munitions. Just so you know, cluster munitions have already been used by both sides in the war.
Yes.
And it's a war crime to use cluster munitions on civilian targets, not on military targets.
Yes.
And I know that cluster munitions have been used on civilian targets, because I was in Mykolaiv around this time last year, and a friend of mine who was making a documentary there, actually, she got injured by one of those bomblets, and I saw the damage to her car. It was pretty phenomenal, much worse than any car crash that you can imagine could do damage to a car. So these little bomblets are extremely dangerous.
Yeah, so ammunition is becoming an issue. The Germans now have promised that they will announce a significant additional amount of munitions, and the Americans are, and it's amazing to think about this, but they are running out of certain stuff that's required. And I wonder what the public mood is. There's just one other factor that is interesting in the note you sent us, Johnny, about Erdogan, the Turkish president who's recently re-elected, a kind of ally of Putin's at times, but he did allow Ukrainian grain-carrying ships to go to the Black Sea with the backing and protection of the Turkish Navy, although Putin wanted to try to stop that. And he also has shifted Turkey's policy in recent days, which you think reflects Putin's weakened position after the attempted coup by Prigozhin?
Yeah, I believe so. I think this is quite a significant shift in Turkish policy. And bear in mind that Turkey grants access to all countries to the South Sea through the Bosphorus.
And is a member of NATO, one should say.
And is a member of NATO and has quite a significant navy. So three things have happened which shifted Erdogan's position in the only in the last week. One, as you mentioned, he has committed to protecting the grain-carrying ships in the Black Sea if no deal on the if the grain deal cannot be extended. In doing so, he pretty much broke with Putin and threatened him with the might of the Turkish Navy. So that was quite a significant move. Also, he extended public support for Ukraine to join NATO. In an interview, he said that they should join and they deserve to join NATO. And he had done a deal with Putin over the leaders of the Azov battalion, who you might remember from over a year ago, holed up in the Azovstal steelworks and right till the end. And then a Turkish brokered ceasefire allowed the commanders and all of them to be brought to Turkey, a neutral country, until the end of the war. So he broke with Putin and released those Azovstal defenders.
Who are Ukrainian.
Who are Ukrainian.
Yes.
Last week. So, you know, delivering yet another fairly significant political victory to Zelensky, who went down in his jet to pick the guys up and posed with them for a photo call.
Yes.
So that, I think, is quite significant. And interestingly, in a recent interview with Biden, he gave a bit of a backstory to how this has all happened. And it's partly due to a deal he's done with Erdogan over getting a Swedish accession to NATO and the delivery of upgraded F-16s both to Turkey and Greece. So it seems that Biden has arranged a deal with provision of upgraded F-16s, possibly F-35s, to Turkey and to Greece in exchange for the shift on policy towards Russia and also gaining Swedish accession to NATO.
Yes, and the question of Putin's weakness or perceived weakness vis-a-vis Prigozhin. And there's another, the two generals who were directing the war, one of them is Gerasimov. He's been sacked over the weekend. You'd know a bit about that and the significance of that. The question of morale on the Russian side of this is critical, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very critical, as is the question of the symbolic image of Putin's power. And what's quite interesting is that it took 5 days for the Kremlin to reveal that Putin had indeed met Prigozhin in person. And you could see how carefully Putin is treading these waters. Obviously, Prigozhin has forced him to the table and forced him to make concessions. So Putin is now in new charter territory for himself at home, where he has been forced, essentially under the barrel of a gun, to fire a general who, to this point, he was very reluctant to fire. So Prigozhin is now very deeply entrenched into the military leadership of this war. So it's a story that's going to have many twists and turns going ahead, but he is not well liked by many of the elite around Putin. And you can be sure that part of the reason there's so little information coming out about this is that people around Putin are all maneuvering and changing and trying to figure out themselves what's happening. But it's fascinating, and it's potentially destabilizing for Putin, but we'll see how it all evolves.
Of course, Prigozhin is as big a thug and a kleptomaniac as Putin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was quite funny to think that the outcome of the rebellion was decided by three people: Putin, Prigozhin and Lukashenko, all of them, yes. you can't believe a word either of them say. So all of these guys are totally untrustworthy and they wouldn't trust each other either. So I doubt that this agreement will hold. We'll see what happens.
Now, Johnny, the mood of the Ukrainian people in the face of what they have endured for 501 days now, something that in the estimation of, America's number one soldier, Mark Milley, will be very, very bloody and will go on for a long time. What is the mood of the Ukrainian people, particularly the ones that you know and the ones of your generation?
Well, the most remarkable thing about life here in Ukraine is how normal it feels. And I think the morale has remained strong partly because of that. The electricity system works. The banking system has always worked. The logistics, transport, everything has always worked from day one. And, adjoined to that is a fairly successful exercise by Zelensky in all matters of the war and in public and international diplomacy. So Ukrainians have always had quite a lot to cheer about since the beginning of the war, despite obviously the war itself. So morale has remained steady and strong and is probably the biggest weapon it has, because people, young men, are still willing to fight. They're still willing to go to war. They're still willing to make that sacrifice. There's nothing stopping them from doing that in the way that there would be in Russia, where people don't trust the leadership. They don't trust the military. So morale, remarkably, given the circumstances, has remained very strong here.
Now, we are told that in a place called Bakhmut, that everyone will be familiar with the name now, it has been a fierce and long struggle between the Russians and Ukraine to have control of Bakhmut. And we're told at the weekend by a Ukrainian general that they are making progress in Bakhmut, which is presently held by the Russians. Can you tell us the significance, if it's just symbolic, Bakhmut, or what's going on there and what's at stake?
I think the significance is it's symbolic in terms of the city itself, because it's not a very important hub for logistics. But given its importance and the fact that, as you mentioned, it's now become very famous worldwide, it will have a big impact on morale of the troops, the Russian troops, if it falls back to Ukraine. Ukraine is making ground in the north part of the city, north of the city and south of the city, in an effort to effect a kind of a pincer movement around the city to avoid the kind of very attritional building to building fighting that could go on in the city. But if they successfully surround the city, it will force the Russians to retreat from there. Simultaneously, it is drawing a lot of Russian firepower, resources, and troops from other places across the front line.
Yes.
So I've just recently come from Kherson, where I spent a bit of time with a battalion commander who is throwing, his troops across the water to attack very deeply entrenched positions on the other side in very dangerous operations with a lot of injuries and casualties, unfortunately. But he told me that the rationale for this is not so much to take the positions over, because it's going to be too hard to take and hold positions on the other side of the river, given that you need to send heavy weaponry to hold positions. But it's a pinning operation to pin Russian troops to that position. So a lot of the rationale for the battles across the 1,000 kilometer front line are pinning operations, just to pin the opposition or the enemy troops into place, while at the same time conduct these sporadic probing attacks with larger amounts of troops and munitions and tanks to discover where the weak point is. So as the attritional nature of the war proceeds, one hopes to find those breakthroughs at various different points. And when that happens, the Ukrainians will mobilize their strategic reserves, which are many of the troops that have been trained in NATO countries and are better equipped. So that's the breakthrough that everyone is hoping for, right, and what the Ukrainian military are looking for. Meanwhile, they are making marginal progress in about three different directions.
Final point. Again, it's about the battlefield. When they attacked Ukraine in their special military operation, as Putin insisted on calling it, they performed very badly, the Russians. But it is a military fact that it's easier to defend than to attack. And they are defending because they've had a lot of time to prepare for what was to be a spring offensive, eventually became a summer offensive. So it is easier to defend valiantly and with your minefields and your trenches and all of that stuff than it is to attack. That is a fact of war. It's also a fact of football, Johnny. Sorry to introduce levity about what is, of course, a tragic fact or a tragic story. But it is the case that Ukraine's progress will depend on the Russians' capacity, and that capacity is that strength is more evident when they're defending than when they're attacking.
Well, you will know as a footballer that oftentimes a team with great character will beat a team that has superior skill.
Yes,
and so therefore the advantage of good morale makes a huge difference on the battlefield. But one other thing, just to address the question you raised about the extra losses that you incur when on the offensive compared to on the defensive. The rule of thumb is that you need to commit three times the amount of troops in offense as in defense.
Right.
And therefore, you lose three times the amount of casualties as the opposition. But Ukraine is following the NATO doctrine of asymmetric war, meaning that they have more precision munitions and less troops. So Russia does not have the precision guided munitions that Ukraine now has, that's NATO provided to them. So therefore, the deaths and casualties on both sides are also asymmetrical.
Yes,
but no one knows the true number, so you know you can't be sure. But certainly, yeah, attacking is more dangerous than defending.
Okay, Johnny O'Reilly in Kyiv at the moment. We're very grateful to you, Johnny. Is an Irish journalist and filmmaker, and we're very grateful to him. And we hope you stay safe, Johnny. Thanks to Johnny. Thanks to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.